This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, make language take a polygraph test. Coming up in today's show, trust. You can trust me. Or can you? I'm just a person who lives in your head. On with the show.
Do you know, I thought it was going to be really easy to define trust. So my definition of trust is a confident relationship with the unknown. And the reason why I ended up with that definition, which took about 5 years to get to, confidence is really at the heart of trust. But if you know the outcome of something, if there is no risk, you don't actually need trust. So what I was trying to pair it with is something unknown, the uncertainty piece. So it's this idea that we are placing our faith in someone or something or a system where you don't actually know the outcome and how it's going to work. When you think of it like that, it's like this alchemy of fears and hopes and desires. So it's got the high and the low. And that's what trust is made up of. It's this friction between these two things. My name is Rachel Boltzmann. I am an expert on trust and the author of a book called Who Can You Trust?
Rachel has been studying trust for the past decade. The word has been in the English language for at least 800 years. We got it from the Old Norse traust, meaning confidence, help or strength.
Trust is really interesting because many words change in meaning, but trust has always, from the beginning of time, we've always described it in the language of faith, reliance and confidence and belief. It's always had those four things within the definition. It was used and defined quite a lot, and then there's this massive gap until around the 1600s where people didn't really talk about trust. It wasn't a word that people tried to define. Then it popped back up, then the 1800s, and then it went silent again until the 1950s when trust theory became a whole discipline in itself. And then it sort of morphed and changed. So in the 80s, it moved from the world of economics. So trust was really something that was used in the world of financial language into the world of social science and behavioral psychology. And then you see the definitions sort of change again, but still have the same meaning.
Was some of the older use, so I guess the 19th century and before that, more religious, and then it became an economic thing somewhat later?
It's a great question. So the thing that we were placing our faith in, so what we were trusting, the definitions were very much around that. So yes, religion, philosophers, leaders, versus thinking of trust as something quite interpersonal and that everyone has sort of the right to trust one another. It's not this upward thing that you trust people that are higher than you or you trust higher forces. So I think that's really interesting in itself. And then the other really big shift was when, this sounds so silly, but when it started to become around your expectations of someone else. So realizing that it was actually quite a symbiotic relationship, that I can't decide whether you trust me. You make that choice. You give me your trust. It sounds so obvious now, but that was a huge shift in sort of people thinking and defining trust. It was when it was realizing the giver, not the receiver, is in control of this, the way this belief works.
And at this point in time, huge shifts are happening in trust. People are less likely to trust institutions, for instance, than they used to be, but increasingly will trust their peers, but are also trusting people they don't know in real life. Businesses like Airbnb and Uber rely on people trusting strangers. On both sides, the customers and the service providers have to trust. And then the likes of TripAdvisor and Amazon that involve feedback from the general public. So on the one hand, you might trust what they have to say more than a business that wants to sell you something. But on the other hand, who are these people? Are they trustworthy? What if they're planted by the business that wants to sell you something? How do we deduce who's trusty and who's not trusty and who's not even real?
So a fake review tends to be very descriptive, so very detailed, but detailed around fairly generic things. So like a fake hotel, they won't actually be able, if they've never been there, right? So they'll describe things that you would see in other hotels or they will get very detailed about the room. But the details that we'll be missing is sort of things like orientation and spatial conception, and anything that's really about the experience of being there is very different from a real review.
Researchers at Cornell University also found that genuine reviewers use more nouns and punctuation, whereas deceivers use more verbs and long words.
But what they've found is that the language is so predictable in what people are using that artificial intelligence can pick up these fake reviews really better than humans, because there's language patterns, which I actually find reassuring that we now have the technology that they'll be able to weed out fake reviews and that machines can detect those better than humans.
Oh, we sweet, credulous human mugs.
We tend to be more discerning face-to-face than in digital environments. So digital environments, we tend to look at a few sort of trust signals, a few clues, and then make a decision. And often what we're making the decision around is that person familiar to us? And we base our trust on that. So it can be as simple and as simple. Oh, they went to the same school as me. Oh, they're from the same region as me, the same color of skin, same age. Like, so the signals, we respond very quickly to signals, which is what makes it sort of quite fragile and even dangerous.
So you could put the same text with different visual cues and get a different response.
Yeah, whereas we tend to be slightly more discerning face-to-face, but we can be manipulated by the same thing. And the interesting thing is people who are masters at deception actually understand trust better than anyone, because they know exactly the information to put in front of you. So they know exactly what you need to believe something or someone. So it's not a case of too much information. They're very clever actually with their timing, and that they realise that they can't build that trust overnight.
Okay, so we're apt to trust human con artists because they're good at making us do that. What about things that aren't actually human?
I have a real issue with, well, the number of machines that are female.
Yes, I'm very pissed off about this.
Me too. I mean, I think gender, I don't know how it hasn't become a bigger topic. How do we accept this, though, that Viv, Cortana, Alexa, Tay, the bots, like the virtual assistant bots, they're all women? I find it awful when you watch young children, particularly, shouting at Alexa. They're shouting at a woman. They're barking instructions at a woman. And so, and the reason why they've done this is they've proven this, that we tend to trust things with a female identity more than a male identity. So there's really interesting work coming out of MIT that when they call a self-driving car, then they give it a male name, let's just say Tom, and then they give it a female name like Viv, and the car does something wrong, they are more forgiving of the car if it has a female gender than if it has a male name.
Is that because of the stereotype that women are bad drivers? And they're like, oh, Viv, classic Viv.
I don't know. I don't know if it's, but that's the thing. Is it purely tied to the context of driving and the stereotypes around that, or will it just extend? Because it's not just in cars now, right? It is in home assistants. It'd be in like the medical app that just launched here, which is like the virtual doctors, Livia. It's a female name. So, you know, is this the start of something much bigger where they know that we tend to trust female identities more than male identities around machines, and so it's just something that's going to be implicit in the design. I'm not an expert on that, so I don't know, but I just think it's interesting and worrying.
It just makes me not want to use them because I don't really want to treat something that is female appearing as servile.
I know, but I am very aware of this and how quickly I can't call it. So I don't know why there isn't more debate around this while we're not speaking up louder, because it could be a huge problem that machines adopt female identities.
Of course, there are male voices for the machines too, like the melancholy original British Siri. Siri, by the way, is a female name in India, meaning wealth, and in Scandinavia, from the Old Norse for beautiful victory. But a few days before this episode, a team of researchers, linguists, and sound designers unveiled Q, a gender-neutral voice that could be used for digital assistants and smart homes. So let's see whether that catches on. But, I mean, why should we be trusting robots anyway? Although maybe they can't be worse than humans. We humans mess up and break trust all the time, and it can be hard to regain it. Although a decent apology helps. So how do you say sorry and sound like you really mean it?
Well, I don't think it's any different from the advice you give a 4-year-old.
What would you tell a 4-year-old?
Do you mean it? So I'm thinking about my children. Right? Yeah. I don't believe you. Don't tell me sorry until you've really thought about what you've done, which then is usually 30 seconds later. I've thought about it. I'm sorry. No, I don't believe you. So like, have they really processed it? Do they really understand what they did? Do they really understand the consequences of what they did? And that this isn't going to happen over, I don't want a 1 minute apology. I mean, this is asking a lot of a 4-year-old. My 7-year-old can get there, right? Because he has a concept of what empathy is. But he will come back 3 days later now and go, you know what? I lied about my serious business, my advent calendar. I really did open every single window at the beginning of December and I hid it under my bed. And I ate all the chocolates on one day. And what he said to me was really interesting because he's like, the lie was worse than the act. But that took time, right? So why as adults do we rush the apology or we think that people are going to believe us when there hasn't been any real change or we haven't really taken responsibility for what we've done? And I think companies make that mistake. And I get it, right? Because they've got their legal teams, they've got their communications teams, and they've got their crisis teams, and they're trying to manage the message. And they're so restricted by what they say that they miss that basic, that feeling that they're genuinely sorry and that they're going to change and that they really acknowledge, they can understand the consequence of what they've done. So it's a long-winded way of saying, I want to believe where you're coming from when you make some kind of apology, even if you don't know where you're going to. So they often I've got to apologize and then I've got to have a plan. No, you can just apologize and say, I actually don't know how to fix this. So I think there's a vulnerability that most leaders, they're very frightened of talking in that language of uncertainty and vulnerability, which is so tied to trust. The biggest jump you can have in someone trusting you is when you say, I don't know the answer to that, or will you help me, or I'm not sure. Like, that's how you earn people's trust. It's not through overconfidence or always telling people you know what the answer is.
So that's really a power move to admit vulnerability.
100%. But you can't do it with the intention of, I'm going to intentionally be vulnerable right now, right? So I'm going to, like, show some vulnerability.
Sorry. But also, I do prefer it when they phrase it as, sorry for this thing that I have done, rather than sorry if you're upset by the thing that I've done, because that sounds like it's your fault for being upset.
Exactly. And this is where I think it's so hard. I'm married to a lawyer, so I know like how much, you know, you cannot take on the language of responsibility and the language of accountability. But I think that's what people are fed up with now. I don't want you to apologize for the way I'm feeling towards you. That's not why I don't trust you. I want you to apologize because you did something wrong or you lied to me. And so that's the feeling that people feel like they're being duped or someone's being disingenuous with them.
It's a precious commodity, trust, and the word is precious too. And so Rachel is worried about it.
It's everywhere.
What happens if a word ends up being a victim of its own success?
I always know when a word sort of is having its moment in the sun, when big conferences, it becomes the theme of the conference. Or I get slightly nervous when you start to see it as the tagline in really big commercial brands, because it's a word that's starting to become co-opted and commercialized because people go, oh, it's resonating with a lot of people. And it's not a brand. Like, trust isn't a brand that you should use. It's a social glue that when it breaks down, it has really huge consequences to our lives. So when terms become so broad that they lose their meaning, they become completely diluted. And this is actually my fear around trust right now, is that it's become the word of the moment that is being used in so many different contexts, that are we actually diluting something, one of the most important words we have in the human language that's so fundamental to our relationships, that are we taking the meaning and the importance out of it by its overuse? It makes me feel actually quite sad. Innovation and disruption and transformation, I could think of 5 words that I could replace that word with. I can't think of another, maybe faith, but even faith is too loaded with religion.
Faith seems more undeserved. It seems more unearned than trust. And it's interesting to me that trust often comes with the verb earn, because it feels like a difficult thing to achieve.
Really difficult to achieve. And incredibly, so confidence isn't fragile enough. So I think we have to be very careful with words that they've stood the test of time, they've had the same meaning, because they are so fundamental to what makes us human, that we don't abuse them to the point where they become meaningless.
Rachel Botsman is an expert on trust and the author of books including What's Mine Is Yours and Who Can You Trust. And coming up in today's Mini-Illusionist, she tackles a term that I have never been able to trust. Influencer.
Influencer seems like such an unvarnished term to put on people that are meant to make you think or feel something in particular. It's like they're not even trying to hide the process anymore.
Yeah, we've been looking a lot at influencers, the connections between influence and trust, how they're trying to be authentic, but there's nothing authentic about it because it feels completely fabricated. We've been doing some research on the history of the word influence. And actually the relationship between influence and trust hasn't really been studied. I think it's going to be the next big thing, like, why do we trust influencers? And one of the things that we've discovered is that the word influence, it came from the word to flow, from a source.
Yeah, from medieval Latin. It referred to the flowing of water, but also other substances and forces and even astrological power.
But it had a very negative connotation. I've never made this connection, but of course the word influenza is related to the word influence, which was given to the Spanish flu because people didn't understand the source of something. They didn't understand that society was being taken hold by this thing. So again, I think that's fascinating when words sort of have positive connotation right now, that, you know, an influencer is kind of like a celebrity. It's something that, well, many people sort of aspire to be.
Rather than something that can kill you.
Or it's like manipulation. I don't want to be a manipulator. Like if Kim Kardashian, what do you do? I'm a manipulator. And I don't think she'd use that term. So how are manipulation and influence related to one another? Is there a difference?
Is there a difference?
Well, this is what I'm trying to work through.
I suppose you can have influence without manipulating.
Well, so I think manipulation comes back more to intent. So when you manipulate, you actually sort of you know what the outcome is. You're more in control of it. It's like you know you want to move that person there. Whereas influence, I don't think you're always thinking about how you want to shape that person's belief or their ideas, which is probably why they went with influencers, not manipulate. But don't think anyone really wants to know they're being influenced.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is ostracon, noun. A potsherd or tile, especially one used in ostracism in Greece or for writing on in ancient Egypt. Going off dictionary for a moment, lest you're wondering what this ostracon has to do with ostracism, in Athens in the 5th century BC, citizens could vote to ostracise someone they thought was dangerous to society or tyrannical or just a tad pesky. They would write the person's name on an ostracon, usually a piece of pottery because broken pottery bits were the post-it notes of their day. And the person whose name appeared on the most ostraca was exiled for 10 years. They were ostracised by the ostracon. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. The music is by Martin Austwick. Find his work at palebirdmusic.com. Find Allusionist Show on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. I just set an account up a mere 4.25 years into the show. And you can find every episode, additional information, transcripts, the dictionary entries for the randomly selected words at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.